welcome everybody to another edition of Coffee and Open Source, a place to meet some new friends, have some great conversations, and maybe learn something along the way. I'm your host, Isaac Levin. And if you're enjoying the interviews here, be sure to like, subscribe, follow wherever you're watching or listening. And also, if you're interested or know any folks that would be interested in coming on and chatting, feel free to reach out to me on Twitter. My handle there is IsaacR11. All right, so with that out of the way, I'm really looking forward to my guests. We're going to have a great conversation about community and tech and all sorts of great stuff. And my coffee's ready. So today, I'm excited. My guest today is Becca Harratt-Wiggle. Becca, do you want to say hello? Introduce yourself.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me today. You awesome. Want me to... Yeah. Yeah, jump into a little bit more about myself.
Yeah, let's talk. Yeah, you want to do a little bit of a little bit more about you, a little bit.
Yeah, sure. So my name, as I said, is Becca. I am a career changer. I spent 10 years teaching college English before I came into tech. I'm a mom of four, so I started learning how to code when my youngest was a year old, I think. And since then, I've done some work in front end. I've done some mobile. I have been in DevRel, and I started the virtual coffee developer community. I see Jessica's in the chat. Hey, Jessica.
Yeah, awesome.
Yeah, so that's kind of what I've been doing the last couple of years.
That's awesome. I'm looking forward to a lot of some of the things we're going to talk about today. We were talking a little bit before the show started, and I think we're going to have a great time. I usually like to ask my guests if they can – if they can think about their tech origin story, like in that point in time when tech came to you, or you said you're kind of a career changer. So do you want to talk a little bit about, how tech introduced itself to you?
Yeah, for sure. So my tech origin story is I wasn't really looking to change careers. I had been teaching college English for, I think, about 9 years at that time. And for me, I went through trauma and it just kind of turned my life upside down. So when I gave birth to my fourth child, two of my organs ruptured into each other. But the doctors didn't believe me when I told them something was wrong, and they ended up sending me home. And I went to a follow-up with my OBGYN a couple of days after they discharged me, and I was still having these problems. And she said, "You're not my problem." And in that moment, it was a pivotal moment in my life, because here I was, the person that I was supposed to be able to trust more than anyone else was telling me that I wasn't their problem. I wasn't a person, wasn't a patient, a problem in somebody else's. And so it took a couple more weeks to find doctors and to fight to get a diagnosis. And when I finally did, I ended up having surgery. And during that surgery, I overdosed on morphine in the hospital because they didn't properly cap my morphine pump. And I went home a week later and I had undiagnosed PTSD, depression, anxiety. I had a panic attack for the first time a couple of days later. And I just really felt like I didn't know who I was anymore. And I was having all of these moments cycle through my head, especially the one of the doctor saying, like, "You're not my problem." I play it over my head every day, like thousands of times. And my husband was a career changer. He had a degree in business and economics, and then he taught high school, and then he had done free code camp, and he was working as a developer. And he said, "You should try to learn how to code." And I thought, "You've got to be kidding me. Like, I can't even think straight right now." But he kept saying it, and he was very persistent. I finally thought, like, okay, fine, I'll try free code camp, and then I will be done with this. Like, he'll stop talking about it. And what I found was when I started doing free code camp, all of those cycles of trauma in my head stopped. And it was like the first time in a year, like, I felt like I could breathe finally. Mm-hmm. And from there, I started tweeting about my journey, and I discovered, like, there's really great and positive people in tech that were out there to support and to cheer me on. And that's not what I was getting in academia. There was not a real sense of community, understanding, growth, and support. And so I finally made the decision. I got a full scholarship into a boot camp, and I made the decision to leave academia and to learn how to code.
That's That's intense, and thank you for sharing. I think, you know, one of the things that I'm always captivated by with career changers is how much they take from their previous jobs that they've done or previous careers they've had, and found out that there's a lot of similarities between the things that they were doing and what they're now doing in technology. Are there things that like stand out to you specifically about, you know, when you're in academia that you I don't know if they directly correlate, but you see a lot of similarities between that and the things that you do now in technology?
Well, I think one of the things that has led to the majority of my success has been my ability to communicate with others and to understand what's going on with the people around me. And so much of that, I think, comes from teaching, because when you're running a classroom of people, when you're diving into dense topics and really thinking about how can you break this down for a broad audience, how can you help them to understand these things better? That's a skill that I guess you learn and develop. And it took me a long time to figure that out. I remember I spoke at a conference. I think I'd been working in tech for a week when I spoke at my first conference. And I just thought that's what everybody did because my husband was doing it. It was natural for me as an educator to be doing it. And then I later found out that like not everybody in tech likes to speak out loud in front of groups of people.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So that communication skill has been incredibly important to everything that I've done.
That's awesome. And I think, you know, that probably bodes well into the whole kind of, I mean, there are a lot of similarities between what you do in academia, like from a teaching or instructing or learning perspective, and how that directly correlates into, you know, teaching people think new interesting things about technology, right? Like, that's what's always been very, very captivating to me, is like they're like a lot of the folks in tech that are, I guess, more open are like well known. They're teachers by trade as well, not just, you know, technologists. So I guess I imagine your first time when you got on stage or you did some presentation in front of people, it was kind of like second nature, right? Like you kind of were like, oh, that's I know how to do that. That's not a big deal.
It was, you know, the process leading up to it wasn't that bad. But then once I got up there in front of my peers, I felt a lot of imposter syndrome. Like I should not be here. There's no reason that I think that I should be up here in front of these people talking to them about these things, which my first talk was about community and gatekeeping in technology. But and I still get super nervous every single time I do it, but I just have this real love of being able to share with other people and to have those conversations about things that I find to be really important in tech.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I think one of the things too that's interesting is, you know, you kind of put on like that hat of somebody who's trying to learn too, right? So when you were, you know, when you decided to kind of transition careers, like I'd imagine initially there was like a little bit of shock, right? Because I like to say this, like technology is not for everyone. Like you need to have a very specific makeup, you know, personality wise, in my opinion. Like you need to be a little bit of a masochist. You like to put yourself through the ringer. You like to kind of be miserable for a little bit because the high of being successful or doing something the right way is really, at least for me, it's really captivating. Like I imagine that you didn't immediately take the technology. I don't think anybody, you know, that career changes takes directly to it. Maybe some do. But like, what were some of the initial struggles that you remember, like learning technology or learning? I imagine you were doing a lot of like, are we doing like front-end development, back-end development?
So I started with the Free Code Camp front-end certifications. Yep. And then when I went to Flatiron, we moved, it was a full stack program. So the first half was Ruby and Rails and the second half was JavaScript and React. And so I actually like felt very much at home in Ruby and I thought it was the right place for me to be. And then my first job was in front-end and I've done that ever since. And so for me, there's those points where you feel really overwhelmed and you feel like, why am I not getting this thing?
Sure.
And this is probably not for me. So why am I even taking the time to do this? And then you find out that some, like everybody else has struggled through that point, or like you're not the only one in that situation. And I found over time that there, I would struggle through something. I can't get this. I don't understand it. I'm not cut out for this. And then I would like wake up 2 days later and I can't even remember why I didn't understand it to begin with. It just like my brain needed to sleep and now it totally understands and there's no knowledge gap there. And so like learning to have that patience was incredibly important because it did happen over and over again. Like I was hitting a brick wall and I thought this is not for me. And then, you know, suddenly I was able to just leap over the wall.
Yeah. Like the shower thoughts thing, like it's a meme, but it's very real, right? Like, you know, there obviously is tons of evidence around, like, if you step away from the problem and you make your mind busy doing something else, the solution to the problem can come to you, right? And I see that all the time in technology where I use this anecdote all the time. Like I had a work colleague who was trying to get something to work and they spent like a week trying to like, just, like staring at like three lines of code, like figuring out like why wasn't it working, all sorts of permutations. And then eventually like they literally walked into work one day, sat down, typed it, and then screamed really loud and then like went and took a smoke break or whatever they did. But like it's just one of those things where, you know, to go back to what I was saying about the enjoying a little bit of the pain because the satisfaction is so good, right? Like I imagine when you're learning, and not even out to this day when you're doing stuff, like do you still get that like euphoria feeling when you like solve something right and you know you kind of like fist pump and scream and do all that sort of stuff, or are you a bit more reserved now?
No, I feel like maybe it's gotten even better because there was so much self-doubt, especially initially, where I thought like, okay, you know, I used to tell my husband like the first 6 months that I was working, like today's the day I'm going to get fired. I just like, no, I'm going to get fired today. He's like, you're not going to get fired. And like, there's no indication that I was, but it was just that struggle. And I had a friend and she was like, it's called growing pains for a reason. Becca, it doesn't feel good, you know? Yeah. And now it's kind of more like that feeling. I'm really into weightlifting. And so when you go to the gym every day and you're lifting weights, like sometimes you see improvements, but sometimes you don't for a long time. And then suddenly you go up and you try and go for a PR in weightlifting as a personal record, right? And then suddenly you recognize like, oh, all of that pain, all of that hard work suddenly paid off. Yeah. And like, there is this intense feeling of, I don't know, euphoria or something that comes with that in the same way that I think that it took me a while to wrap my head around that in coding. Like it's the same thing. I'm taking these little steps. I'm working, I'm exercising every day. And one of these days I'm going to hit a PR and that this time it'll probably be a good pull request. So
yeah. Oh, very good. Very good. Yeah. The micro tear analogy for like muscle building is definitely very interesting because I do feel, you know, obviously our brains don't tear when we're learning new things, but like I've been very guilty of like I work out a lot too. And if I like, okay, I'm not going to do like this particular exercise for whatever, a week or whatever. And I come back and I do it and like, oh, this is substantially easier. Like that idea of like muscle confusion or whatever you want to say. Like, so there is something well documented about stepping away, trying something new, having your brain focus, having your muscles focus on something else will like help, I guess, get you past that plateau or that barrier that you have. And I don't know if you feel like this too, as somebody who is like, they haven't been in tech for like their entire professional life. Like technology in general has given us so many opportunities to like play around with new things and enabled us, but like there's also a lot of noise, right? Yeah. Like there's too many tools, there's too many frameworks, there's too many opinions. Like, you know, initially I imagine all that noise was probably very, I don't know if the word terrifying is right, but it was probably like gave you some anxiety, right? So what were some of the things that you used to kind of combat like, oh, there's a lot of inputs here and I need to make this kind of like decision flow of what I want to do, or else I'm going to go down this path of doing something that I might not want?
Yeah, for me, it was really important to talk to other people who are doing those things and they're already doing them well. And so finding that way to interact with others and learn from them has been crucial to how much I've grown over the last couple of years. And, you know, my husband's a second career developer, so I could talk to him about things. And then once virtual coffee started, you know, in 2020, there was always a room full of people who were willing to answer questions, talk about the decisions that they've made. And now that we, you know, we have a Slack, we didn't, well, we've had a Slack for a while, but initially we didn't. And I just will read the Help and Pairing channel all the time because I might not need to know that thing right now, but I can think in my, I can learn more through reading how, one, how other people are asking questions, two, how other people are answering questions, and then three, who is the person that answered that question in a way that makes sense to me? And that's the person that I can go to when I have a problem and I know that they're going to be able to break it down for me.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think, you know, I think you and I are very similar in the world in the thought of like community helps strengthen everybody around it, around you, right? Like, you know, I'd love to talk a little bit more about virtual coffee. Let's do that in a little bit. I want to kind of still sit in this area of like career changing for a bit because it is fascinating to me. Because, you know, especially, you know, you build your opinions like immediately when you start in technology, I think, right? And it's very, very hard to change those opinions. So if you're not around your peers learning, I guess when you were in Code Camp and you were kind of been, you were given like one direct path, like do this course, you'll get a job, you'll make some money, you'll be happy, right? At least that's my opinion of like the value prop of Code Camps. I mean, yours might be a bit different and I'd love to hear it if it's different. But I guess at the end of the day, like it's very, very interesting that they probably forced you into a particular way of thought, but eventually you have to branch out and learn new things, right? Was there stuff that you learned during that Code Camp that you were like, I don't want to do this ever again?
That's a really good question. I think probably my answer back then would have been testing. I was like, I don't understand the purpose of this. Why are we testing? But now I love testing. Like I'm a Cypress ambassador for a reason because I really enjoy writing tests. But for me, I like to see the practical application of things and really get a sense of what's going on with that. And when you have a program that has like four files, you don't really need tests for that, right? And so when I started working my first job and we had tons of stuff going on, it made sense to have tests. And then I was able to wrap my head around it. But I can't really think of anything that, well, listen, I really hate spreadsheets. So anything that has to do with a spreadsheet, like makes me instantly bored. Sorry for all my spreadsheet lovers out there. And maybe someone will convince me that spreadsheets are amazing one day, but that kind of stuff can be really, really hard for me to deal with.
Sure. Obviously you have never seen like the spreadsheet, like e-Olympic things, like the e-sport spreadsheet competitions.
I was just looking at that last week. Like, what is this?
So, I mean, I think of a similar thing. Like I like spreadsheets because it's like my brain kind of works like that, but I never appreciated spreadsheets. And then I saw like people do like absolutely insane stuff with spreadsheets. I was like, oh, okay. I get it now. But I totally agree. Like if you like, there's definitely some monotony in any job, but there are some jobs that have a ton of monotony and like crunching data, looking at spreadsheets, looking at rant. Like one of the things too, that I have a hard time with is like reading like business design docs or business decision docs. Like, because because I immediately try a solution pretty quickly. And like a lot of those docs are very robust and like, we want to do this particular thing for this particular reason. Right. So I always have to read those things like 40 times to actually absorb what the goal is. Obviously, I'm guessing with your background in academia, you love to write those sort of things, right?
Okay, so I have a take on that. So
okay, no, I'm here for it.
I have a couple things. Let me try and organize my thoughts, but they're probably not going to be. So here's my tangent. One, there is this company. I think it's called Useful Fiction. I think it's useful-fiction.com. And one of the things that they talk about is there's a lack of effective business writing. And I taught business and professional writing when I was in academia. And this is, it's really important to me because I think part of the issue is it's so dang boring, right? Like nobody takes the time to make it interesting or help you to understand. And that type of writing is the same thing as when you go into a meeting and people are reading directly off a slide. Like mm-hmm. I can read mm-hmm. the slides myself. I don't need you to read them out loud to me. And now the second part of this tangent is, I don't know if you know who Mark Rober is, but he is an engineer and he, I think, worked for NASA and Apple. Yep. And anyway, he's got a YouTube channel and he has a subscription box called Crunch Labs. We are not we are not sponsored by Crunch Labs, but I would love to be sponsored.
Mark Rober, if you're hearing me and your 400 million YouTube followers, subscribers, I will gladly take them for free. Anyway,
me as well. So I was doing the latest Crunchbox box with my 11-year-old, and it was, I can't remember the title of it, sorry Mark Rober, but you create this thing. I can't even remember the right technical term. See, I have failed. But you're making curved shapes with straight lines, so it's kind of like a spirograph kind of thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, in the video, Mark Rober talks about the importance of telling stories. Like you can be effective in sharing your data if you tell a good story. Yes. People are not going to remember all of the boring details that you gave them. And so you have to be able to construct a good story in order to be effective. And I think that extends to all of those boring business reports that we read too. You know, why is it purposeful? Why is it meaningful? What does it have to do with the mission? What does it have to do with the values? And why have we come to this place right now? And when you provide that context and when you tell that story, then people are way more likely to be able to remember and to connect to the thing and to want to be on the same path and strategy that you are. And I think that, you know, there are different versions. You can hand some people a spreadsheet and that's good enough for them, but that's not good enough for everyone. So there's different ways to provide your audience with information. And like, that's a huge part of technical writing. Well, thinking about your audience and how to present that information. But if you can't connect with your audience, then you are more likely to not succeed in what your mission is for that thing that you're presenting to them. So there's my tangent.
That take is totally rational. Like I think you're expecting somebody to be like, that is a ridiculous. No, I completely agree with everything that you're saying, but I want to make one comment, what you said at the beginning, like there's no other thing that would be the worst course to take than like how to write business docs in college or university or whatever. That sounds like the worst class ever. No offense to anybody that had to teach a class like that, but that sounds absolutely horrible. But yeah, I totally agree, like the storytelling aspect. And I, you know, we're both speakers, so like this storytelling thing resonates even more with us. But I believe the storytelling idea resonates across all sorts of areas. It doesn't have to be in tech. It can be in science. It can be in history. It can be whatever, because as humans, all we want to feel is some connective to what we're hearing. And if we don't, we tap out, we look at our phone, we whatever, right? If you can capture somebody's attention with a good story or lead them down some journey that's really, really interesting, you'll win them, right? Even if your content is junk, right? Like even if your talk is junk, but if you tell the story well, it always works great. I saw this TED Talk, sorry, a few years ago where a guy was given like four prompts, like to the audience, like, I'm going to talk about four things for 5 minutes. And they just shouted out stuff to him. And he did this entire, like, very, very calm, collected thing with, like, nonsense words. And it was captivating because just the way that he was able to connect dots and tell the story overarching, like, off the cuff was really, really impressive. And I totally agree that storytelling is probably one of the most important skills to learn, I think, in my opinion, in life.
Yeah. And that's that company Useful Fiction. They go in and they help create military strategy and create it in a way that makes sense. They're telling a story of what's going on, and they teach executives how to be able to tell the story of what they're doing and create presentations that focus on the storytelling and not the data that is disconnected from the human condition.
Sure. Yeah, and I think that's the underlying important part, like the human condition, right? Because everybody wants to feel like they're bringing value or they're being treated as like the thing. Like, how many times have you clicked on like a catered ad? Like, this ad speaks directly to me. Like, I mean, not really, but like, I feel like this ad is talking directly to me. And same thing with like, you know, movies that make you cry or music that makes your toe tap, right? Like, it feels like you're brought into the entire thing. And so what are some of the things that you've seen as effective? Like, obviously storytelling being very, very important in your previous career, being very, very important in your current career. Do they have a lot of similarities as to how the stories are told? Or is it because the audience is different in most cases, like the way that you need to like convey the story is a bit more different?
Yeah, you know, I think that it always depends on your audience, and every audience is going to have different expectations. But I talked a little bit about this in my storytelling talk, and it goes back to the idea of the rhetorical triangle, right? And that might be familiar to some of you. If not, the rhetorical triangle is this idea that to make a good argument, there's ethos, pathos, and logos. Okay. And so there's this balance triangle. I don't think we need the balance triangle. It just depends on your audience, but pathos is an appeal to emotions. How can you connect to somebody and appeal to their emotions? I think that in this world today, that's probably the most important thing that we're doing, is trying to connect to emotion, because you have 30 seconds to get someone's attention or less, right? And that's the fastest way to make that that connection. Ethos is your credibility. So how do you showcase that you're credible and when you're talking about these things? So for example, I'm talking about the rhetorical triangle. I've mentioned that I spent 10 years teaching college English, right? Like, yes. So there's a little bit of credibility. You should think, well, maybe she knows what she's talking about based on her experience. And then there's logos. That's the logic of things. So how are you backing up your argument, or how are you supporting what you're saying? And so I think in some way, how we're telling a story, no matter what, finding a way to show that you're credible, that you know what you're talking about, that there's other people or resources that can support your ideas, and connecting emotionally, those are all key parts of creating a good story. It's just going to depend on how much time you have and who your audience is, how you're going to balance that triangle.
Yeah. And one thing too, like, and I've said this a few times, like, all the stories have already been written, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, if the hero's journey, the whatever, like all of these, like if you watch a movie or you watch a TV show or even listen to somebody's talk, like no stories are original. It's the adaptation of the, like the concept, which is original.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that's very, very interesting, especially as hearing, like, you know, I could even tell, like, you kind of went into like speaker mode just now when you were like, okay, here are my things, and I need to talk into my things, and then I'm going to pause and wait for a response, right? Like, so here's a random question. Do you catch yourself occasionally just like in presenter or speaker mode? Like, because, and I'll answer first. Yes. I feel like all the time I catch myself, and my wife is looking at me and she's like, you know, it's just me, right? Like, I know everything that you do out there is bullshit, but but do you have the same sort of, I guess, personality trait?
Yeah, I found more recently that I have been doing it a lot more, and maybe like I spoke a lot last year. That's probably the most I have ever spoken. Mm-hmm. And I will find myself, and I'll catch myself like, what are you doing? Like, just be a normal human being. But I think part of it too is, since I've been talking on these topics for a couple of years now, that so much of it just kind of goes on autopilot. And I try and make sure that that doesn't happen, because I also find that if I go into autopilot, like I tell you the mission of virtual coffee, because I can do that without looking at anything now, that I start to, it becomes more of a performance and not a connection or an interaction. Mm-hmm. And I don't like when that happens. Yeah. So I'm like trying to be very cognizant of when that does happen, but for sure that happens.
Yeah. I caught myself a few months ago, and I was talking to somebody about speaking at like their virtual meetup or whatever. And they said, and I was just curious, so like, roughly how many people do you get? And they're like, oh, it depends. Sometimes X, sometimes Y. And I'm like, okay, well, I can present to nobody. And I said that, and I was like, that's probably not a thing to brag about. Like, because presenting to nobody means that it doesn't matter, right? But what I was trying to convey is, like, I know the content well enough, and I like talking to literally one person if they're there. But I definitely do see a lot of speakers fall into this trap where they just kind of deliver. And then, like, if anything happens that's kind of outside of their control, like somebody asks a question or a demo fails or the PowerPoint clicker stops working, like they have like this moment of like, like, have you run into situations where like something has not happened the exact way and like you froze? Or do you have that, like, the maybe the my approach is more self-deprecating where I immediately go into like complainer mode? I'm like, oh, this stupid thing, like whatever. And I try to make a joke out of it.
Yeah. So somebody the last couple months asked me, like, what was your worst, it wasn't your worst experience as a speaker, but it was like your worst performance, your worst delivery as a speaker, which I thought was a good question. And that was probably one of my talks last summer, actually. And it was a talk that I was really nervous about. I was giving it for the first time. I had a lot of people there. It was an intro talk. And then when I asked how many people had used the technology, a lot of them raised their hands. Sure. And then I immediately felt like, oh no, I am in over my head. This talk is not for them. And then, you know, when you speak at conferences, people often get up and they leave. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's your own fault and sometimes it's not. But once there were a couple of people who were like sitting in the middle of a row that got up and left. And I also have ADHD. Yeah. And so it's just like immediately my focus becomes that thing. And then I start going down this spiral of like, okay, what's happening here? What am I saying? I should skip something. I should be done with this talk, you know? And so like trying to recover that, I'm getting better at it. And I was talking to someone about, he was like, here, this is how you make a joke about that thing. Mm-hmm. But it's just trying to like find that way to get my brain refocused on the things that I want to talk about. And it was a good experience in that I also learned what I want to be talking about and what I'm comfortable being able to go back to in those situations. And so, there are definitely those times where I feel that way and I have to figure out like how to regroup or just like run out of the room and never show my face in tech again.
Well, please don't do that. That'd be a terrible idea. So I typically, and this is just something that I do, I think, to break ice a little bit, like I'll be in a room and, you know, depending on the size of the room, the joke lands better or not, depending on the size of the room. But like, I'll say like, oh, like who knows about topic that I'm going to be talking about? And if like people raise their hand, I literally be like, you shouldn't be here. You should probably go like across the hall to that talk, because that talk is probably way better. And like, the audience then realizes like, oh, like this person just cracks jokes the whole time, which is my style. Like I'm very self-deprecating. I just kind of rant about stuff. But I've realized that like, if you can connect with an audience almost immediately with like something, because self-deprecating is very safe, right? Everybody likes a person that makes fun of themselves, which is kind of a bummer, but it's just how life works. Do you at times, do you kind of feel the need to, you know, I guess get some approval from an audience, or like, cause this is one of the things I struggle with. Like I have this really deep entrenched, like I want people to love me sort of thing. Like, do you have a similar thing, or you're like, I could care less what people think. Like if they enjoy it or not enjoy it, they're there. And, you know, hopefully they take something positive out of it.
Yeah. I almost try not to think about it. And, I am always my hardest critic. So there's only been one talk that I've ever given where I came out of that and thought like, hey, I did a pretty good job on that talk. So I usually complain to my friends and like, I just did a terrible job. That was really, really awful. And then I feel bad. I'm sorry. Because then they're like, it wasn't terrible. You were fine. It was a good talk. Right. For me, it's just, how can I do better, I guess, for the next time? And how can I deliver something that I'm proud of? And I feel like in January, I finally was able to do that.
Yeah, it is quite interesting to me, like the idea of like requiring satisfaction, like requiring like acceptance. Because I think in society, like we just all want to be wanted, right? Yeah. So if we're going down this path of like, oh, I'm losing an audience, and this maybe is a different conversation, but like, I'm losing an audience. Like, what do I do to get this audience back? You know, you're 20 minutes into your hour long talk and you see people's faces starting to drift, or it's after lunch and people are getting tired. It's like, how do I get them like to pay attention? Because like your example of people walking out, like walking out to people doesn't really bother me because I immediately turn it against them. Like, oh, they probably, there's something wrong with that person. Like, why would they leave? This talk is great. Like, they can't be like, so, but I guess my point is how, like, do you have some tools or tricks that you've used in the past to like win back an audience or win back somebody you're talking to that might be drifting concentration a bit? Or do you not care?
Yeah, no, I do care. And I think that being vulnerable in a moment where it makes sense and it's natural to can be a really great way. And I also think like definitely have had kids fall asleep when I was teaching. So, you know, what do you do to engage them? Okay. Think about the things that interest them, ask questions. I'm not a huge fan of calling on people because you just don't know what the situation is, but if you can engage the audience in some way, and you know, I frequently have somebody in the audience that I know that I've talked to before, and James Quick is really good about doing this. So he'll say like, hey, is there anything that you need from me? Like, do you need me to come with an example or yell out something, you know? And so then he becomes like my backup person. Like, okay, yeah, maybe I'll open it up for questions. Hey, I'm going to pause here. Does anybody have a question? And that's an opportunity for someone to jump in, or the person that you planted in the audience to ask their question, or ask them something, you know, rather. When I gave my talk on storytelling, you know, I asked, I think maybe like one word to describe you or one word to describe an experience, right? And then people start yelling those things out. And I also find that the people that are yelling them out are usually the people who are engaged, but it also starts to bring back the people who are not engaged because they see like, okay, well, like it's like some kind of implied peer pressure or something. Yes, well, they're following the rules. Like I guess I should too, you know?
Yeah. No, I can directly relate this to something that happened when I was in college, because I was very guilty of the person that was having to pinch their leg all the time. Like, I don't do well like as an attendee in a lot of hour-long settings because I get distracted or whatever. And I remember this person next to me was like one of those people, I don't know if you're like this, that like literally like pages of notes for every lecture they went to. Like, those people are exhausting. Power to you, but super, exhausting. But like, I just made a glance over at her and she had like 7 pages of notes and I'm like, oh, I have to pay attention, I guess. Like, so I kind of like, to your point, I had that level of peer pressure where, you know, I didn't want to be judged for being the person that fell asleep in class or wasn't paying attention or whatever. So I had to kind of jigger the way I think about things. So you said you are a copious note taker. Is that something that you do by habit, or is it something that you had to teach yourself because, you know, maybe you would get distracted more often than others?
I think it's probably because I have ADHD and I wasn't diagnosed until a couple of years ago, but it all kind of makes sense to me. If I am not taking notes, it is way easier for me to not pay attention to anything someone's saying. And so I think I just developed really good note-taking skills at a pretty young age in elementary school. I feel like maybe 5th grade, I started to like really pick up my note-taking game, and it just kind of proceeded to follow me because it was important for me to be able to identify these things that learn. I also don't have a great memory. I forget things a lot. And so I need to have that thing that I can study, but you know, it's very much aided, I think, my ability to retain information, to know where to go for information, and then to appear organized. I'm not an organized person. At almost every boss I've ever had is like, you are the most organized person. I'm like, listen, you should see all of the cups on my desk. I've got one drink. I've got a water bottle. I've got a coffee mug. I've got another drink on the floor. Like I've got stuff all over the place, but my notes are always going to be organized. And I think that's like my brain trying to say like, look, you can do it. Yeah. You can be organized and stay focused on things.
It's like your coping mechanism a little bit, right?
For
I imagine, you know, I don't mean that don't take this any way other than just as a joke. You must have been a hoot in fifth grade taking a bunch of notes. I could just imagine, like looking over and the girl next to me is right. I'm like, oh no, like. But I mean, and maybe this isn't fair to say, and if it's offensive, I apologize. But like, you know, I imagine like at a point in time, like it led you to this path of academia, right? Like you have to be very structured in academia. You have to like, you have to care a lot about the topics that you care about, right? Did you realize, I mean, obviously it worked out and then it didn't work out, but like, was academia something that you wanted to be a part of like from a very young age? Or was it something where it's like, oh, I guess I'll get into academia. That seems like an easy way to like get a job.
Well, you don't go into academia in the English department to get a job for sure.
Sure. Okay. Fair enough.
I wanted to be an attorney since I was 11 years old, and I would love snow days because we would have 2-hour delays if there was snow in the morning in Ohio, and that would give me enough time to watch Matlock in the morning. Loved Matlock and like every lawyer show out there. Matlock was with Andy Griffith. Anyway, it was very good. I think he only lost one case and he threw it on purpose because the person was guilty, which I'm pretty sure you're not legally allowed to do. but anyway, so my whole life, I thought that I was going to be a lawyer, and I went to undergrad. I did get a degree in English and I graduated in 3 years. And I thought like, I'm going to go to law school. And then I didn't do a great job on my LSATs and I didn't get into the schools that I wanted to. So I got into my second pick schools and I didn't want to do that. I really wanted to go into human interest law and it didn't work out. And so then I felt very lost because for the last 10 years of my life, that's what I wanted to do. And so as I was nearing my last year of college, recognizing that this is changing, I ended up going and getting a job. I taught adult education for a year, adult literacy. But what I found is that I really am a teacher at heart, and I enjoyed that experience of being able to help and share with other people, to have small conversations, and to find ways to make meaningful impact on people's lives. And actually, probably being an attorney was not the right role for me because there's not a lot of that personal action happening, you know? And so it led me to go get my master's in English. And it was a really, really rigorous and hard program. And there were times that I certainly wanted to give up and quit, but it's one of those decisions that I won't ever regret because I think that it's benefited me so much in my life. I've learned a ton. I really dove into thinking and analysis in ways that I never even knew were possible there. Yeah. And it still was skills that I use today.
Plus, it means that you can probably write a really good doc, which I think is probably like the number one skill that a developer needs is like the ability to write a good doc. You talk to most developers, and he's not a fair word. Talk to most developers and they're like, yeah, doc is not the thing that I want to do. Like, that's not my jam. Like, let's do something else. Let's write some code. Let's do some more exciting things. You know, here's a question for you. You know, as we transition a bit, away from like the career changing, you know, how we are, public speaking, like that sort of thing, like transition to like community building a little bit. So like, you know, obviously in academia, and I don't know if this is an incorrect assumption or observation, but there's not like a ton of indirect community in academia. Like you talk to other professors or might talk to people that have similar interests as you, but like, it's not as, I guess, vast as say, for instance, like a community on tech or a community in social media or whatever. Right. So, you know, when you switched over from, you know, when you made that career change, and I can tell that you have a passion for community. When did that show up? When did that interest lay? Was that something that was there when you were in academia or when you were in school? Or is it something that, you know, as you interface more and more with developers and people in the community, you're like, oh, this is fun?
Yeah, so my first full-time job actually outside of college. So I taught for a year and then my full-time position was as a community organizer for a nonprofit organization. And I think when I was in that role, I've tried to reject community building for a long time in my life, sure, because I would say, like, I'm an introvert, I'm shy, this does not make sense. But then I just kept getting drawn back into it. And yeah, one of the things that I didn't like about academia, I was an adjunct, which meant I was part-time. And so there's not a lot of community that happens in academia. Yeah. There's a lot of politics that's being played. There's a lot of, sure, competition for roles and things like that. And it just felt like a very toxic space. And I was trying really hard to create a community of people, of part-time instructors, because we impact the students in huge ways, but we have no say in anything that really happens. And so for me, when I started to learn how to code and I started tweeting about my journey, I saw all of these people out there that were willing to be part of my community and to support me. And then that led me to a group of moms who were either learning to code, who were already in the tech industry, or who were interested in it. And it just felt like a very safe space for me. And so I got really involved in that organization and have really carried that through with me in all of the things I've done. And I'll also say that I think a lot of what I've learned about community comes from my experience with trauma as well, because, sure, one of the things that I learned that helped me to work through a lot of the issues that I was facing was that we should not be alone when we're in, yeah, trauma. We shouldn't be isolated. Yeah. And, you know, as adults, most of us have gone through some form of trauma, right? And so knowing that there are so many communities out there is a really beautiful thing. And I don't like to think of it as competition. What I like to think of it as, there's opportunities for people to find the space that's right for them, that helps them to feel safe and be able to grow and to form those connections. So I think that, you know, that community spirit has always kind of been with me. And it's just in the last couple of years where I finally was like, okay, fine. I will embrace the community spirit.
Yeah. But I think, you know, one thing that I'd love to hear from you too, like, embracing the community spirit or being a part of a community is one thing. Leading and driving a community is a whole different thing, right? So I guess, when did you realize, like, because there's a lot of traits that you need to be someone like that. When did you realize, like, hey, I could lead communities, I could organize communities? Because again, like, that's something that's, I guess, at least for me, wasn't something that was immediately like, oh, that's in my DNA. Like, I had to kind of learn how to navigate that world.
Yeah, it's so funny because it's also one of those things that I didn't realize that I was doing, and also didn't, yeah, realize it was a strength. Somebody that I go to for advice all the time, Jamin from Infinite Red, he and I had this conversation in a Twitter space kind of about the same thing last week. And, you know, why did you decide to do that? Or when was that moment? And for me, for a long time with Virtual Coffee, I kept saying, like, I'm not doing anything special. I'm just opening up Zoom and sending people a link. Like, anybody could do this. Mm-hmm. And he was like, not everybody will do it though. Right. And, yeah, thinking about my past experiences, my family was really big on supporting other people in the community growing up. So, like, if there was a need, then my parents were there to fill that need. You know, if there was something that wasn't happening, they were there to volunteer. It's like, this is why I'm a soccer coach for U8, right? Like, they needed a coach and I showed up. So, yeah. I don't know if it's just a personality trait or what, but I think it just comes down to that idea of making sure that everybody feels supported and has the things that they need, and that I find joy when that happens.
Is it safe to say that you have, like, a lot of, like, motherly traits in that particular world? And I don't mean that in a negative way or whatever, but, like, do you feel like, and maybe this is coming from an area of personal whatever, but, like, I've always had that person in whatever job I've had that was kind of like my mom or like my parent. Like, and I don't know if it's because maybe I come off as somebody that needs a parent, I don't know, but like that person that's kind of guiding you and making sure that you're maybe not always doing the right thing, but you're being thoughtful in the decisions you're making. Is that something that, you know, obviously I think if you're a parent, you build those things because it's required for being a parent, hopefully. But is it something that you felt like you naturally had those sort of skills? Or is it something like, oh, like, I like to tell people, like, and give people advice on things?
That's a good question. I think that that's a skill that I'm working on getting better at. And I've said, I tend to be really tough on myself. And my brother and I used to write screenplays together. And he can tell you I can be very difficult to work with because I can be like very blunt about things or like, no, this is the way that I can be very stubborn. You can also ask my husband. He can also verify both of those things. And so for me, actually, probably within the last 5 years or 6 years now, since I went through the trauma, and it just kind of it allowed me to understand empathy in a very different way and how important empathy is to learning, growing, and feeling supported in things. And so I think that's the big thing there. You know, now I want to try and think about things from other people's perspectives and try and take some time to slow down my brain and not judge other people based on where they're at, because nobody has the same journey. And it's not fair for me to say, well, like, hey, if I did it in this situation, someone else can do it. You know, you don't know someone else and you don't know their experience and their history. So I would say that I feel very strongly that it's important to listen to other people and find those ways to support them, because there's a lot of lack of support happening in the world today, and that doesn't build bridges, that burns them.
No, I 104 million percent agree. I need to make one comment. Like, you just kind of ca casually toss it in there. Like, I used to write screenplays, like whatever. That's fascinating to me, because as somebody who has had an idea for a movie for, I kid you not, 25 years, haven't written one word about it. Like, what is it about? And I'm guessing because of your English background, it kind of like, oh, I could be a writer of some creative content. Do you treat creating content or creating, talks or whatever in content in general, do you kind of have like a similar style and approach that you would when you were writing like traditional creative content?
I try to keep it that way. Otherwise I don't enjoy it. And you can read some of my blog posts and you can tell that's one that she didn't enjoy writing, right? And I don't like that. I don't ever want to. I know that I have to sometimes, but I try and find the story that I can tell that gets me excited about talking about that thing. And I've blogged throughout my entire coding journey. I think I wrote my first blog 5 years ago. I retweeted that very first blog post, which was definitely not my best work, but you know, it takes finding your style and your voice. And so for me, I like to be able to carry that through all of the stuff that I write, because I hope that it shows that I enjoyed writing it and I wrote it for whoever's reading it. And I don't think it matters who that person is, whether or not I've had a conversation with them. But for me, it's about finding that special place that connects with the person on the other end.
Do you tend to take multiple, like way too many passes at things? Or do you trust yourself enough that where you write something once and you just then you do a pass of like grammar and whatever and then you ship it? Or are you, because the reason why I mentioned this is because I have a lot of friends who, blogging is a big part of their job, or doc writing is a big part of their job, and they get a bit too anal retentive regarding like how copy looks and how things like that. And in my opinion, you lose a lot of your voice the more edits you do, right? So like, what is your thought on that in general?
Yeah, I think that there's a real problem with spending a lot of time, especially so many people in DevRel have to push out so much content all the time that if it, there's two things, right? Like one, if you I find that people will make the content like very sterile and bland because they just need to push out this writing, or they over edit it, like you're saying. And so for me, if I'm writing personally, I very frequently just push it live without even reading it over. I'm like, I'm happy with what I wrote, and there's probably typos in there, and maybe I'll go back in a couple of days and check them. But for now, that's what's most important to me, is that I get this out into the world, and I don't really care if anyone reads it or not. That's totally fine with me. So When we were writing screenplays, when my brother and I were writing screenplays together, that was a different experience. We revised that, but
sure.
I mean, it's a little bit different. You want to capture your characters in the right way and make sure you're speaking in the right voice all the time. And when you have multiple writers, like, you just have to really make it seamless. And also we were trying to get it made into a movie. So like, there's a lot more competition than for somebody to read my blog post on, you know, like 5 ways to give good feedback or whatever.
Yeah, sure. Sure. Yeah. It is interesting. Like, and I do mention this occasionally, like the interlaps between creativity, like the more traditional forms of art, like drawing, music, creative writing, what have you, and technology, like, it is not like completely separate areas of the world. Like, you know, you hear like, oh, are you a left brain person or a right brain person? And I think that if you're in technology, if you're a developer or a design or a front end developer or whatever it is, like, there's a ton of creativity needed. And if you're like a back end developer, there's a ton of elegance that you need to, as you build solutions, right? And that requires creativity. Let's be honest. And I'd love to kind of hear your thoughts. Like, what are some of the key overlaps that you've seen as somebody who has either written or read a lot of people's writing, and now where you've written and read a lot of people's code? Like, what are some of the similarities you see?
So I talked to a woman a couple of years ago, and I think she was in a neurology program for a master's or a PhD, but she was also a musician. And one of the things that she said to me, everything in the world is pattern matching. And that made a lot of sense to me, because no matter what we're doing, whether it's art or music or writing code or math, like, you're finding the pattern and that's leading you to the answer. And so it's just being able to identify those different patterns. So even when we're writing, even when we're using creativity, we are looking at patterns that we've seen before. And this goes back to your idea of there's no new stories, right? Every story has been told. Yes. And so in that way, like, we can recognize what those patterns are and we can apply them in the ways that match what we're doing. And I think in a lot of ways, coding is kind of like poetry, because there is a very specific pattern that things need to happen in, but there's also different styles of doing it. So one person might write a program one way, and somebody might take that exact program and use a different style. And so as a coder, and one of the things that's hard as a new developer is recognizing that, hey, there's not one right way to write this code. Yes. There's going to be different approaches that people take. And so you just need to be able to identify what works best for the code base that you're working with and the team that you're on.
Okay, I can't phrase it any better than that. Like, that was very succinct. I mean, it's just, I think we could all take to put our English 101 hats on and be like, let's let's be creative. Like, and I don't know if you ever had to teach like an English 101 class, but when I took it in college, it was a lot of like let's just like free flow of thought, right? Like, you know, because you have the whole spectrum of individual in those classes, right? And not everybody's going to be a great writer, but people can, they feel some connectivity tissue to something, right? And I'd love to get your thought on this specifically, because there's been a lot of conversation around it, and we're about the top of our time, so I think it's a good place to start, right? As somebody who used to be in academia, and I don't know if you've had a take on this already, so I apologize, but, you know, in academia, and now we're in this world where we have lots of natural language prompt-based tools to help us create content or decide or help us get to the answer faster for things. And there's been a lot of, I guess you could say, disruption in the academia space around cheating and people not doing their work and what have you, right? I'd love to get your thoughts on, is this actually something to be concerned about, maybe put on your professor hat? Or is it something where, no, like, new tools now exist, like, we should take advantage of those tools so we can be successful in society?
Yeah, I love it. I am here for all of the cool things that we have out right now. And this kind of relates back to my origin story. So, you know, I had that doctor who told me I wasn't her problem, who refused to acknowledge that I had any issues. And so Last week, I typed into ChatGPT all of my symptoms and my history, and I said, give me your top five diagnoses, and it got it right on the first time. And it was like, wow, I knew it. I was like, this is going to send me into a tailspin, but I'm going to do it anyway. But you know, it's the idea that it can help us. And somebody said, well, you know, it can give you a wrong diagnosis too. I said, yeah, but it can help me to better advocate for myself. Yeah. And so I think that it's a mistake to reject these tools and say, this is just hype and this is fleeting. I think it's important to say, this is another tool for my toolbox. How can I use it? And from the teacher's aspect, I kind of would love to go back to the classroom and teach English with this, because one of the things that we can do is rethink why we are teaching what we're teaching. What is important about students writing this paper? What do we want them to learn from this? And if it's just like, oh, we just want them to write a paper, well, then that's meaningless. And the students see that reflected, and you'll see that reflected in the content of their writing. Yes. And so find a way to make it interesting for them. Find a way that they're not able to cheat by having ChatGPT write the paper for them. Have them write a personal narrative and then research details they need to integrate into their paper. That's going to make it a lot harder, but also they're probably going to be involved in that process a little bit more because you're tailoring it to what they're interested in.
Yeah, I completely agree. I also believe that the five-paragraph essay is kind of a large determining factor for a lot of things in writing. Like, not to knock the I am going to knock the five-paragraph essay. It really has no value. I mean, at the end of the day, like, if you're writing five paragraphs and two of them are like not valuable at all, then what's the point of having them as paragraphs? Anyway, that's a whole rant for a different day. I could go on that for a while. But I think one of the things that you said is like using the tool to adapt to how we want to be better individuals. And I think, you know, I love your idea of like have them write something about themselves or a narrative about themselves and do some research, right? Like ChatGPT or OpenAI or Bard or any of these services, like they don't know anything about you. Well, unless you're famous, unless you're Becca, and then maybe it'll know stuff about you. But like for the most part, like if you're a student, like the thing doesn't know anything about you. And, you know, sure, there are some things, like there are some areas of study where history or literature or whatever, where it's like, okay, like there's rampant ability to just kind of skip to the end, right? But if you're doing writing and writing about with something with your own voice, the thing, like, what do they say? Like it writes like a C average. Like it has like the skills of a C average student, which is still cool, but like, shouldn't we yearn to get more than C's? Right. Yep. Like, so anyway, that's my rant on that. But I appreciate you kind of providing your insight, 'cause I think it's great too. You know, as we wrap up our show, again, thank you so much for being on the show and chatting with me. This has been great. I do like to ask one last question at the end, and it's probably the hardest question you'll get asked, and I apologize. So if you can think of technology and your career in tech and, you know, the idea of changing careers and community building, all the things we've talked about over the last hour or so, but you only had one word to describe what that feeling meant to you, like what word would that be? And just, I'll put a little pin in it. As somebody who has an English background, I expect it to be a very good word.
Oh, awesome. Thanks. I appreciate
No pressure.
All of the pressure on me. Okay, so one word to describe my career journey. Is that what you're asking for?
Yeah, or the feeling that you feel or the feeling that you would attribute to technology and community building and all these things. And if you want to take it out of your career journey and lesson, you can, but it doesn't directly have to be like identical or correlate to it.
Okay, does it have to be an adjective? What part of speech are we looking for? I'm just trying to buy time because I don't know what my one word is.
I was about to say, like, where is she going with this? It can be any word. It could be nonsense word. It can be, so like, for instance, I'll give you some examples. So some people have used the word empowering. Some people have used the word community. Some people have used the word love. Some people have used the word terrifying, like so on and so forth, right? Like most of them are adjectives, let's be real. But some of them are nouns, and a couple of them have been verbs in the past.
I'm going to go with vulnerability. I think that's probably the one that I think of that's been so impactful to me. You know, it's been an opportunity to listen to other people, be vulnerable. It's been an opportunity for me to be vulnerable myself. And without that, I don't grow into the person I am today. And so to be able to experience that has probably been the most impactful thing in the last 6 years that's happened to me.
I love it. I can't think of a better word to describe technology and how we should feel about it and how it directly relates to how much we care about things. So I really appreciate that. I also appreciate you being on the show and chatting with me. And as we wrap up,
yeah,
Becca,
thanks so much.
Is there anything that you'd like to, you know, plug shamelessly or add or throw out there, you know, and as we wrap up?
Yes, I will plug. I have a podcast with my co-host, Dan Ott, and we are the Virtual Coffee Podcast. And also, we are live streaming lightning talks this Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern time on our YouTube channel, which is at Virtual Coffee IO.
Awesome. Well, I'll definitely provide some links to that in the notes for the show. And yeah, again, thank you so much for being on the show, Becca. Thank you for the folks tuning in. And I hope you enjoy the rest of your day. This is Isaac Levin from Coffee and Open Source. Take care.
Thanks, Isaac.